First of all, I'll apologize for reading from a paper, but some of the things, as you'll see, I had to put it down on paper so that I got it all in the right order. But I hope I've written it in an informal style, an informal colloquial style. I'd like to begin by thanking Wiebke and Gerda-Lisa for inviting me to give this paper at this event. They invited me because of the work I'm doing in my long-term research project, which is called Anti-Humanist Curating. And this project explores writing, art production, and curatorial practices that contest liberal humanist theorizations of the values that are most important to us in our post-industrial societies. Principally, this project contests the tenets upon which curatorship has been premised for the past 200 years or so. In particular, the project contests the idea that curatorship delivers something more than that which art can deliver on its own. Curatorship has been principally defined over the past 200 years within Western societies as an activity that can order or interpret or bring knowledge from or otherwise make some sense of artworks. And my argument runs counter to this in that I propose that curatorship should embrace its role to shield art from the ideological forces that would demand order or sense, or rather useful sense or knowledge from art. Now, I should point out that this project is extremely unpopular, especially amongst curators. And I've been in communication with some of the world's most celebrated curators, trying to interview them, mostly. And they are, each in their own ways, very reluctant to engage with some of the ideas that this project explores. And that in itself, I think, is a really interesting question. So the main questions that my research addresses is to ask what it is that curatorship can do, that it can do for art, or what it can add to contemporary art. Now, this is a more complex and problematic question than it may at first appear to be. The problem that I propose is that contemporary art doesn't need any assistance in explaining itself. It doesn't need any help in delivering whatever it is that it has to deliver. In fact, contemporary art is the very deliverance of itself within the framework of curatorship. There's some sort of technical bits like that that I do throughout the paper. That's why I had to write it down. Artworks basically don't need explaining because, in my perspective, there's nothing within them or beneath them or behind them to explain. Now, this seems to leave curatorship in a very problematic position. It's almost a condition of redundancy. Now, certainly, in terms of the key European enlightened liberal humanist values that created the possibility of curatorship as a discipline or some sort of function for art or within art, it's redundant. My project proposes that neither truth, beauty, or justice can be measured within artworks, and therefore, because the artwork is beyond measure, it cannot take part in the formation of knowledge of the ideological categories of equality, fraternity, or liberty. So you can see why this isn't terribly popular. So to explain this in some detail, I'm going to tell you a short story, and then I'll talk about a work of art, this work of art. So I recently gave a paper on curatorship, contemporary art, and the problems of their relationship, as played out in most museums and galleries, and the paper was given at the University of Essex, where I work. It was delivered to the whole postgraduate cohort within the School of Philosophy and Art History, which included all of the MA and PhD students. The paper was called The Violence of Loyalty and the instrumentalization of justice in curatorial modalities. And it largely referred to the 2008 Swedish vampire movie, Let the Right One In, directed by Thomas Alfredson. In the paper, I try to explain two things. One about how artworks work, and the other, a proposition on how the relationship between the curatorial and the work of art, or rather the work of artworks, can work best. Now, in regard to how artworks work, I suggest that they can do two things, and that these things are analogous to what it is that vampires can do. Now, vampires can either outright kill human beings, or they can turn them into other vampires. This capability has two different outcomes, two different transubstantiations. The first is that by outright killing a human being, vampires can turn a subject, a specific individual human subject, in other words, a person, into an object. In other words, they become a dead body, just an inert pile of goo and bones, matter or material. If, however, the vampire turns a human being into another vampire, they transform that subject into a living dead body. And I call this new thing a matrixial object. But what I mean is that the human subject has been transformed into a more complex thing. It's definitely an object because it's dead, according to the values of humanness. So, this matrixial object thing. What I mean is that the human subject has been transformed into a more complex thing. It's definitely an object, as it's dead, according to the values of humanness. In other words, it's definitely an object, according to the measure of calibration of humanist values. It is, however, both an object and a subject, but the subject status is a radically different one, because in its very being, it does not and cannot be differentiated or partitioned as either object or subject. Now, the ramifications of this are that the vampire's very being destroys the different ontological statuses of a body, destroys the possibility of defining those different statuses. And it does this by radically synthesizing them in such a way as to make impossible a theoretical separation of them. It's a bit like baking a cake. You can't get the eggs out once you've baked a cake. You know, you can't get the flour out. You can't separate them. Ordinarily, we separate the value of our material being, an animated pile of goo and bones, and its value from our value as a subject, as a human being, as a person, as an image of humanness. And this is why vampires are monsters. They're a chimera of object and subject, fused and woven inseparably together in a way where they can't be defined or discerned as separate. Their ontological status confounds the categories of a given ideological system. Or in other words, the vampire exists outside of the given law, but is created from within that field of the given law as its ultimate logical, but grotesque, endpoint. In technical terms, its sovereignty exists as an excessive immanence of the given system of law. Now, basically, that means that it is an excessive and errant manifestation of the logic of the given system of law. And as such, it cannot be measured. It can't be calibrated, or more importantly, it can't be conceptualized within the given framework and mechanisms of that law. Because it's an excess, which just means it's a thing without being. Excess. Or a thing without the being of its being, being able to be valued or measured. It's excess without being. This means that it's beyond the measuring function of knowledge, but it's also radically within knowledge as such. It's just that it's a new, unknowable singularity, or an infinitely and thus excessive complex plurality. So what I'm doing with this is making an analogy that artworks work like this as well. However, their prey is language. Artworks, when they really work as art, if they really are art and not something else like propaganda or something else, they take elements of language and they strip them of their subjective potential within the given sphere of that ideology from which those subjects come. They evacuate these elements of language of their ability to draw forth subjects or images or values. The artwork strips language bare, as Marcel Duchamp would put it. Now, in stripping these packets of language of their ability to conjure up subjects, or in other words, images or values, they leave behind some kind of residue that is like the object status of language. And this is something that we very rarely experience, because we use language almost intuitively once we've learnt it. It's so quick and present in a way. What's for sure is that what the artwork does to language is to rid it of the possibility of being sensibly placed within a coherent conceptual schema. Or in other words, the language packet is unable to coherently deliver knowledge when it is trapped within this action of the artwork. Now, if we propose that at their very core, artworks are nothing but packets of language, albeit very special packets operating in this peculiar way, then it's reasonable to conclude that an artwork cannot bring forth a coherent conceptual schema and thus cannot be instrumentalized into an ideological knowledge formation or matrix. Now, this doesn't happen very often. An art does get assimilated into, some artworks do get assimilated into an ideological system. And that means that they fall out of the status of working as art in this schema. And this is something that Marcel Duchamp talked about when he said that artworks can flux in and out of being art. They're not always art. They might always be there, but they're not always art. The trouble is that this peculiar excessive status that I'm describing is very, very fragile. It's like a delicate but powerful wisp. Duchamp called it infra mince, or infra thin. And because of this fragility, I suggest that the role of any curatorial framework is simply to shield the artwork from any mechanisms that would seek to have it operate in any other way, like a familiar who protects and keeps secret their vampire companion. In particular, one of the most corrosive mechanisms at play in museums and galleries is knowledge production. This is my view. Museums and galleries all across the world are under genuine pressure to measure and justify what it is that they do. In one sense, of course, this is quite reasonable because tax revenues help to sustain such organizations, so they should be useful in some way to their constituencies. I fully understand this, and I agree with it in part. However, because of this overwhelming pressure from politicians and from audiences, these arts organizations tend to measure the value of their activities in easily understandable mechanisms. That is, that they use mechanisms that are easily understandable in terms of ethical demands, because ethical demands can be measured or calibrated. Today, across the world, the key measure of the value of the activities of museums and galleries is the production of understanding, of knowledge about art, of course, for the benefits of what gets called lifelong learning for citizens. My position is that the demands should not be for ethical results, but instead they should be for political potentiality. Now, to produce such ethical results is all well and good for, say, social history museums, or natural history museums, or science museums, or even historical art museums. They can deliver this kind of knowledge really well. They're specifically conceived and designed for this purpose. However, I believe that it's no good for museums and galleries that work with contemporary art. And I use the term contemporary in a very specific sense, which I could talk about later. The reason for this is that if you try to penetrate contemporary art, to extract knowledge from it, you destroy it. You turn it into something that it isn't, because you disrupt this fragility that I'm describing. You disrupt its political potentiality. Okay, so let's go back to this story about these postgraduate students. Several of the PhD students got pretty angry with what I'd proposed. Almost in unison, they appealed to me, "So what's the point of working in this way then? What's the point of art, and what's the point of working as a curator if you don't help people understand this stuff?" Now, I understand their frustrations, and to a degree I sympathized. What I realized is that they were acting out the tensions of a very uncommon experience, the experience of reaching the limit of one's knowledge schema. Now, trained in a very particular way, as particular types of art historians, they were searching for some way of coherently categorizing or otherwise ordering their experience of artworks as knowledge. They were looking to fit it all neatly into an already established schema of how they think the world is. However, they were trapped within what philosophers call a category error, which they couldn't see, but which they were beginning to feel. Now, this error is that they were asking an epistemological question to an ontological problem. And of course, the questions being in error simply bounce right off the problem, which means that I was a bit rude to them. They were asking a question about the theorizing of knowledge, epistemology, to an impenetrable thing, artworks. They were asking, what's the point, which just means, what does it mean, or what's the value of this? They should have been asking, what is this? Or better still, what isn't this? What is this not? Which is an ontological question, a question about being. So it's like asking, the epistemological question is in error, because it's like asking, what does a tree mean? Or what does cheese mean? Or what does the being of a human being mean? They don't work, those questions. They're not the right tool. Answering these kind of questions definitively is to propose and designate a place within a coherent conceptual schema of knowledge for the thing in question. And doing this turns the thing into a value, or rather, into an image of the thing in question, into a subject. Okay, so this really tells us what art can do. Experience of art can really bring us to a point of sensibility where we can feel the so assumed already pre-established schema of how we perceive the world to be, and it can make us feel the shape of the constructions of these schema. In other words, it can make us feel the edges of our knowledge. What it doesn't do is give access to some transcendental knowledge, some higher truth beyond these edges. But at best, it can make us realize that our knowledge has edges and shape. And it can make us think that these knowledge schema could be different shapes, that they could have different edges. It can make us feel that our knowledge is contingent. Now, the French philosophers Gilles Deleuze and Félix Guattari call this the affect of conceptualization. They talk about how art can make us feel the affect of how we conceptualize knowledge. Indeed, make us feel the happening of the schematization that is our knowledge. In other words, they believe that art can make us think thinking, and that it can make us feel the shape and edges of the thinking that we are doing in the moment of that thinking. This affect can have a very powerful effect, but it's fragile and fleeting. The effect that it can have is to make us reconsider our values at a very specific level, at the level of subjectivity. And this just means that it makes us reconsider what we are as subjects in the very being of us as subjective beings. Or in other words, it can make us see the world differently at the level of our experience of it as objects. At its very best, art can make us feel like we've experienced our perception of the world as a complex object, a matrixial object, which includes us within it. That is, that it can make us experience language as an object and our place within it as we use it, as we use language. So I'm just going to finish, that's the sort of theory bit, and then I wanted to bring in this example of this artwork by the American artist Robert Barry. So you've had a chance to read this several times, and I'll just say a few words about it. So what I'm proposing in this paper is that artworks like this produce a kind of anti-knowledge, a kind of unknowledging function. And it's the job of the curator, or rather the conditions that the curator tries to control, to shield artworks like this from those forces that would try to make sense out of them, from those conditions that would seek to bring forth knowledge from them. What needs to be preserved, I'm arguing for, is this very delicate state that artworks put us in when we encounter them, where we can feel simultaneously the happening and the unhappening of conceptualization. In other words, when artworks work, they simultaneously assemble and disassemble a knowledge schema. And this is an amazing feeling, and I think this artwork does that very clearly. So one of the reasons that I mentioned Marcel Duchamp briefly earlier is because I got this example from the last section of a book called The Duchamp Effect. In the section at the back of the book, some of the most famous art historians and theorists in the world are discussing key works of conceptual art that they believe have been influenced by Duchamp's oeuvre. Now, in one example, Thierry de Duve and Benjamin Buclo are arguing about this Robert Barry piece. Basically, de Duve says that he thinks that the time and date at the end of the artwork, as you can see, gives a kind of signature of Robert Barry, making Barry the author of the work. And then Buclo wades in to flatly contradict this by saying that Thierry de Duve is totally wrong, and that the work conforms to the Duchampian dictum that it is the viewer who completes the work. And he goes on to explain that the work does a very special, complex thing, which is that it instantiates a complex I. The word, and single letter word, I, in its use of the word I, because it deploys it twice. It doesn't instantiate a simple subject form of the word I by simply referring to the subject Robert Barry. Instead, the artwork dislocates the subject potential of the word I by allowing it a potentially infinite number of subjective locations. And this occurs because we can't help but feel that it refers, of course, to Robert Barry, but also to us as the reader or viewer. But it also refers to all the past readers and viewers, and all the possible future readers and viewers, all of the infinite eyes that could and could have engaged with the work. Now, this radically disperses the subject reference of the word, turning it as a packet of language into what I call a matrixial object. That is, an object with infinite but undeployed and undeployable subjective potential. It's like it's full of knowledge or values or meaning, but we simply don't have the tools to get at these things to draw them out for the purposes of instrumentalization. Exegesis, or rather interpretation or explanation here, is made impossible. Instead, we can only experience diegesis, which is the form of the recital, the form of the telling, but without a conceptualizable, knowable subject being conjured up. Now, this occurs because Barry's artwork sets us a totally impossible task: to think of all the things you know, but of which you are not at this moment thinking, and all the things he might have known, but of which he wasn't thinking at that point in time, together. Now, either one of these things is impossible to think, of course, let alone both at the same time. And then if you wrap into the equation all of the possible others who have experienced this or are experiencing this now, then your brain really starts to hurt. So we become trapped in the instant of the being of the I, the moment of the instantiation of the I, and our place within this instantiation. This becomes a circumstance. It produces a circumstance, definitively separated from all other circumstances. As we travel around the simultaneously empty and infinitely full instance of the I, we just go around this empty but full hot space or something like that. It's truly an experiment, an experimenta, without a border of thought. It produces an infinite thought that cannot be conceptualized because it is materially present in the material of thought as experience of thought. It produces a sublime effect within the affect of conceptualization of language. It basically produces a radically metaphoric instance. And like all infinite things, it cannot be measured, and so it cannot be assigned a stable value, and thus it cannot be considered as producing knowledge.